From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The turmoil in Ukraine is apparently under discussion at the UN. Russian media reports that the UN Security Council began closed-door consultations on Ukraine late Friday, hours after the country's ousted president, Viktor Yanukovych, insisted that he has not been overthrown. He held a press conference early Friday in Russia. Yanukovych appeared before reporters in the southwestern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don, less than 2 hours' drive from the border with Ukraine. He denounced the new authorities in Kiev as young neo-fascists and said terror and chaos were now prevailing in the country. He blamed what he called the irresponsible policies of the West for the crisis in Ukraine. He also apologized to the Ukrainian people for not having been stronger during the crisis. The Ukrainian leader spoke just hours after Ukraine's self-appointed interim authorities said they regained control of two Crimean airports seized during what it called an armed invasion by unknown forces. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama late Friday accused Russia of interfering in the internal affairs of Ukraine and warned them of possible consequences.
Good afternoon, everybody. Over the last several days, the United States has been responding to events as they unfold in Ukraine. Now, throughout this crisis, we have been very clear about one fundamental principle. The Ukrainian people deserve the opportunity to determine their own future. Together with our European allies, we have urged an end to the violence and encouraged Ukrainians to pursue a course in which they stabilize their country, forge a broad-based government, and move to elections this spring. I also spoke several days ago with President Putin, and my administration has been in daily communication with Russian officials. And we've made clear that they can be part of an international community's effort to support the stability and success of a united Ukraine going forward, which is not only in the interest of the people of Ukraine and the international community, but also in Russia's interests. However, we are now deeply concerned by reports of military movements taken by the Russian Federation inside of Ukraine. Russia has a historic relationship with Ukraine, including cultural and economic ties, and a military facility in Crimea. But any violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity would be deeply destabilizing, which is not in the interest of Ukraine, Russia, or Europe. It would represent a profound interference in matters that must be determined by the Ukrainian people. It would be a clear violation of Russia's commitment to respect the independence and sovereignty and borders of Ukraine and of international laws. And just days after the world came to Russia for the Olympic Games, it would invite the condemnation of nations around the world. And indeed, the United States will stand with the international community in affirming that there will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine. Now, the events of the past several months remind us of how difficult democracy can be in a country with deep divisions. But the Ukrainian people have also reminded us that human beings have a universal right to determine their own future. Right now, the situation remains very fluid. Vice President Biden just spoke with the Prime Minister of Ukraine to assure him that in this difficult moment, the United States supports his government's efforts and stands for the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and democratic future of Ukraine. I also commend the Ukrainian government's restraint and its commitment to uphold its international obligations. We will continue to coordinate closely with our European allies. We will continue to communicate directly with the Russian government, and we will continue to keep all of you in the press corps and the American people informed as events develop. Thanks very much.
We'll have more on Ukraine later in this report. A hospital which was ransacked in South Sudan during the ongoing conflict in that country has been described as shocking by a senior UN official. UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer visited the teaching hospital in the town of Malakal in the Upper Nile state, where he described seeing nothing but dead bodies. More than 70,000 people have fled their homes around the country after violence flared up in mid-December between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and former Deputy President Riek Machar. Lanzer said his team managed to go into the center of Malakal under extremely difficult and dangerous circumstances and reach people in need of protection. He spoke with journalist Regina Gorrell after his visit and described what he saw both in Malakal town and in the UN compounds, which are home to thousands of internally displaced persons.
So I came to Malakal for the first time in 4 weeks, and this is a city that's deserted, a hospital that was in tatters. I'm really very, very moved by what I saw in Malakal. I was here 4 weeks ago with Valerie Amos, and it was a city that was coming back to life. Well, that life has come to an end. People who were seeking protection in one of the last churches standing in Malakal, 1,756 people, and we've managed to go into the center of town under extremely difficult and dangerous circumstances, and we've been able to take those people into a much safer situation inside the UNMA space. But a United Nations that's standing strong. I mean, I'm so proud of what the team here has achieved over the last few days. People who were seeking protection in one of the last churches standing in Malakal, 1,756 people, and we've managed to go into the center of town under extremely difficult and dangerous circumstances, and we've been able to take those people into a much safer situation inside the UNMA space. So job well done, but it's been a fast-paced and very moving visit today.
And how can you describe the situation in the camp? I'm talking about the POC site in the UNMIS log base, because we've been hearing complaints from the IDPs that the humanitarian situation in the camp is not that much good, and they are asking if UN can improve the humanitarian situation, shelters, water, sanitation, and all health and everything. How can you describe it, and what do you tell these people?
Well, I think the situation in any camp, in any setting, is never as good as people would like. A camp is a last resort. It's what we really don't want to have people inside our bases or inside a camp setting. We want people to be able to get on with their lives and to take care of themselves. And if you can provide assistance to people outside a setting of that nature, it's all the better. But at the moment, what we've got is a highly insecure environment in Malakal, and people were seeking protection and shelter with us. So we'll do the best we can to get them enough water, to get them enough food, to get them the medical attention that they require. But, you know, we could throw resource at this more and more, and people will never be entirely satisfied. And I understand their feelings, and it's a terribly overcrowded setting. So what we're doing is developing a new site to decongest, to give people a bit more space. But at the end of the day, what the United Nations is doing here is the most vital thing, and that is to keep people alive. It's to protect them. And I don't think anybody is questioning that or has any qualms about it.
Do you think your visit to Malakal pushed IDPs from the Christ the King Church to move into the camp?
Yeah, I want to be very clear. I mean, every move is voluntary and people make their own decisions. And whether people move to an UNMA space or whether they leave it has to be their decision. And we're not the people who will take that decision. What we offer is an opportunity to come inside our base, but nobody is under any obligation, and quite the opposite. I think if people do feel safe enough to stay in their own homes or in other settings, then we'll do everything we can to support that. But I'd have to say that at the moment on the ground in Malakal, I wouldn't second guess anybody's decision to come to UNMIS as opposed to staying in a town that is deserted, destroyed, and under severe stress.
The unrest in Greece continues. Scuffles broke out Friday between demonstrators and police outside the finance ministry in central Athens. The protests took place as Greece's international debt inspectors met with ministers to discuss the pace of further fiscal reforms. The ministry's cleaning staff, school guards, and municipal workers were protesting job cuts required under Greece's bailout agreement. Riot police used pepper spray as protesters attempted to block a major avenue in the capital's main square outside the ministry. More than a dozen protesters were detained earlier after attempting to enter another nearby government ministry. China on Friday issued a report on human rights in the U.S., which denounced it for foreign drone strikes, state-sponsored spying, and rampant gun crime. The document came after the U.S. State Department issued its own annual Global Human Rights Report on Thursday. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
China has published a report responding to the report by the United States over the human rights situation right around the globe. In fact, in that report, China says that there are still serious human rights problems in the United States as of 2013. The report says that the U.S. presents itself, and I quote, as the global judge of human rights and has made arbitrary attacks and irresponsible comments on the human rights situation in other countries. The report calls the U.S. Stapping program, that is the NSA's wireless tapping program called PRISM, which exercises, according to this particular report, long-term as well as consequences both at home and abroad. It calls it a blatant violation of international law. The report also mentions that there are child laborers working in the agricultural sector in the U.S.
And another first for the Syrian opposition, a Twitter first on Friday, the live tweeting of the amputation of a hand. The amputation took place in the remote rural town of Maskana, in the northern province of Aleppo, according to a series of tweets posted to the account of a supporter of the opposition group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The first tweet contained a photograph of a blindfolded man with his arm positioned on a table as a masked man wielding a sword waits nearby. Another man is reading a statement. The caption says the blindfolded man is a thief who had asked to have his hand cut off in order to cleanse his sins. A second photograph was taken just as the sword is about to strike the hand while the victim is restrained. In a third tweet, posted an hour later, a photograph shows the man who appears to have passed out with his bloodied arm and severed hand resting on the table. Fresh slashes in the wood suggest it took four swipes of the sword to cut off the hand. Nevertheless, the U.S. State Department's annual report on human rights was silent on the atrocities committed by its allies in the fight against the Syrian government. Instead, the report criticizes Damascus as the villain.
It's no coincidence that the first use of a weapon of mass destruction anywhere in the last quarter century came from a dictatorship in Syria in trying to suppress a popular uprising.
In a study that proved what should have been obvious to everyone on planet Earth from the outset, researchers in Japan have learned that when people lose their towns, their homes, and their health after a nuclear disaster, they get depressed. A Japanese university surveyed survivors of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power disaster. Japanese international news agency NHK World filed this report.
Many people attempting to recover from the physical effects of the 2011 disaster in northeastern Japan are also struggling with depression. A recent university survey indicates that over one out of four residents may suffer from the disease. A team from Tohoku University conducted the survey. Members interviewed nearly 3,800 residents of Miyagi Prefecture beginning in May 2013. The project's leaders said the results suggest depression is even more widespread than expected. He said the outcome could have been even worse if more people had participated in the survey. University officials say they plan to work with medical specialists and other organizations to combat the problem. They say they will continue to provide telephone counseling by clinical psychotherapists.
The last elected president of the Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, in his first appearance since he left Kiev a week ago, held a press conference in the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don Friday. During an hour-long Q&A with the international press, he said Ukraine had been taken over by nationalist thugs and called for the restoration of his government.
You have the floor, Mr. Yanukovych, please.
Thank you. Distinguished viewers, journalists, it's high time for me to announce my decision to fight for the future of Ukraine against those who use fear and terror to take the power. And I've decided to go public about it. No one has deposed me. I was forced to leave Ukraine because of the threat to my life and the life of my relatives. As you know, The power in Ukraine was seized by nationalist, pro-fascist youth mobs who represent a minority of the Ukrainian population. How do I see the solution out of the crisis? We need to fulfill what was laid down by the crisis settlement agreement between the president of Ukraine and opposition leaders in the presence of the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Poland, as well as a representative of the Russian Federation.
Немедленное начало и завершение в сентябре 2014 года конституционной реформы.
To embark on a constitutional reform and finish it by September 2014. The reform needs to balance out all of the branches of power, the authorities of the president, the parliament. Then we need to hold presidential election in December of 2014, and then to adopt a new constitution. Of course, it's very important to conduct an unbiased investigation of the acts of violence, of course, given the monitoring of the European authorities, and all of the arms and weapons need to be handed over to the police. All of the buildings and streets and squares need to be deblocked, and barricades need to be removed. All of the armed gunmen need to leave the streets. We need to ensure normal life for the citizens of Ukraine, including in Kyiv and other regions of the country. We need to take into account the interests of all the regions of Ukraine. It will be very difficult to get out of this difficult situation. The turbulent time that we faced and the casualties are the consequences of the political crisis that Ukraine faced. This is the result of the irresponsible policy of the West, which connived at the Maidan opposition forces. But Ukraine is a strong country, and we will prevail. We will get out of this crisis. And I also urge to hold a Ukrainian referendum. As for the issues that will be put on that referendum for vote, we need to discuss these issues with the participation of the broad spectrum of the civil society. And of course, they have to reflect the relevant problems that the country is facing, and also in terms of the state and state order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yanukovych. I'd like to hear out some questions. The first question is to be asked by my Interfax colleague. You're welcome to ask a question. Oh, the mic isn't working. Please introduce yourself. The mic isn't working. My name is Mikhail Prokhorov from the Interfax agency. From the ITAR-TAS agency, excuse me. Please just talk as loudly as you can. Mikhail Petrov, ITAR-TAS agency. Yesterday you said that the agreement concluded in February, the 21st, was not fulfilled. And my second question is that the judges of the Constitutional Court have been deposed in Ukraine. The Russian Constitutional Court has already provided some feedback on that. How could you comment on that? Thank you.
Thank you. I got the question. The agreement that was supposed to give a solution to the crisis had to be completed by both sides. And I believe that the international intermediaries were reliable. I believed in the bona fide character of their mediation. This agreement was controversial, but despite that, I signed it, and the leaders of the opposition signed it too. The ministers of foreign affairs of three states also signed it. It was a critical decision at that point. According to it, the opposition and the radical elements that were present at the Maidan and in other regions, they had to hand over their weapons to de-block the areas they seized, but that was not enforced. And as a result, Kiev was flooded with gunmen that started pogroms, they started to destroy houses, cultural facilities and churches, and innocent civilians suffered. People were robbed and beaten up in the streets, and that is still happening. That is why that agreement gave a certain hope, but what ensued later, it's hard to describe. This is lawlessness, terror, complete chaos and lack of power. So these are unprecedented decisions that were taken by the parliament through force. Some of the MPs were subject to physical violence. They cast stones at them. They were intimidated, and they were taken to Maidan Square, where they took an oath of loyalty by force. This is, of course, cannot be called the job of the parliament. This is the job that was done by Maidan opposition forces, suppressed by the gunmen at Maidan and the Silovikovi. The parliament did take those decisions, and the government, which they called the Cabinet of Victory. So, is this the victory over the Ukrainian people, I'm asking you? It should have been a government of national unity. That's what we were discussing back then. So, today, it is difficult to find the proper words to describe how the power is being formed today and who's there in the power. The names which became known across the world, Yarash, Porubi and Takhnibok, these are the people who promote violence. They are well known beyond Ukraine, they're well known around the world, and in Israel, they incite fear. And I believe that the Ukrainian parliament is not legitimate, and I still maintain that the settlement, which was not fulfilled,
если бы оно было выполнено или если оно будет выполнено.
Given the condition that it will be fulfilled, it could have calmed down the situation to a certain extent and would launch the legal process of resolving the political crisis in Ukraine. That was a way out of the dead end, and the radicals have forced us into this dead end.
The second part of the question about the judges.
This is an unprecedented move. Not just for Ukraine, but for any country of the world, when a constitutional court is destroyed by and the state and the statehood itself is destroyed, we should not allow this to happen.
Journalist Kate Zickel from Radio VR discussed Yanukovych's predicament and Ukraine's perilous path with analyst Dmitry Babich, who spoke with her from Moscow.
He basically said that he was not toppled legally, but he left the country because of a threat to his security and to the security of his family. He said that, you know, the so-called protesters shot at his car, at his convoy in Kharkov, that even his grandson, a small grandson who is now at kindergarten, was included in the list, in the black list of people who are now in power in Ukraine. So he basically said that parliament, which is now controlled by the Maidan protesters, that this parliament is illegitimate. All the laws that it is passing, that it is going to pass, are illegitimate because they don't have the signature of the president. The president is still alive. He was just forced to leave the country. He described what happened as a fascist takeover of power by a small group, or what he described extremely extremist nationalist fascist groups, you know, which represent a small minority of Ukrainians. This is a big question. Is he president or not? Because legally, there is a special procedure that must be fulfilled in order to remove the president. Just like in the United States, there is impeachment, which is a legal procedure. The same thing in Ukraine. And it had never been, it was never fulfilled by the new forces that control the Rada. So legally speaking, Yanukovych may claim to be the president. We understand that he doesn't have real power anymore.
No, he doesn't. Alexander Turchynov is the new interim president of the Ukraine currently.
Well, that's what he says. But legally speaking, Alexander Turchynov has no right to be the interim president because there was no impeachment of the previous president. And the procedure was not fulfilled at all. I mean, the whole thing is illegal because this agreement between Yanukovych and the opposition that was signed and guaranteed just on paper by the EU, you know, the three foreign ministers of EU countries, it was not fulfilled. So the whole thing is absolutely outside the framework of the law. That's the problem.
Well, Dmitry, we do need to move on here, but I did want to ask you briefly, Yanukovych's future plans here, did he mention anything in his speech regarding where he's planning to go now, or did he say anything about asking Russia for asylum?
Well, he said that he talked to Putin on the phone, that he has not yet met Putin personally. He said that he had to flee Ukraine. He described what happened after he disappeared from the public radar. He said that he was basically, his helicopter was intercepted by fighter planes. It was forced to land near Kharkov. So he took a car and he crossed the border by car. He said that he will stay in Rostov, which is a city in the south of Russia where he gave that press conference. He's going to stay in Rostov and not in Moscow, because he has friends in Rostov who agreed to give him room and board. And he said that he didn't give the order for the policemen to fire. He said that the policemen started to fire only when they were directly threatened by the protesters and when protesters themselves started to use fire weapons. So he also explained why he postponed the signing of the association agreement with the European Union. He said it was for economic reasons, because it would ruin Ukrainian industry and especially agriculture. So these are the new things, things that we haven't heard from him before. The other things are more or less the same that he said when he was still in power.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.